Hey, it's Tia Carrere, and you're listening to Kino Kingdom with Britt and Rupert. Party on, guys.
I'm ready to rock.
Yeah, sure.
Evening all, and welcome to Kino Kingdom 86. There's been a little bit of a gap because I actually died and came back to life. So, yeah, it was a hell of an afternoon that was. Yeah. Luckily, my best friend is Robert De Niro's character in Angel Heart. So he helped out. What's his name? Isn't his name like Bob Devil or something in that? Louis Cypher.
Really, really obvious.
It's Louis Cypher, yeah.
Right, yes. See what they did there.
Yes, badly. See, there's a lot going on. I know you've got, I don't know if I keep it a secret or not, but I know that you're going to talk about a series of films that I'm very, very much looking forward to hearing about. I just wanted a couple of things before we dive in. The first thing is, you saw Predator in the cinema recently.
Yes.
And I just wondered how it was, because I'm not a cinema goer, but then on the night I was actually thinking, oh, I bet that's amazing.
Oh, yeah. It sometimes you watch films from yesteryear at the cinema, and for various reasons it can be a little bit disappointing because it's like a bad transfer or the film just doesn't quite hold up compared to modern standards. But watching Predator, you realize actually it's a really good way of watching it, and it really holds up, and it's so intense, actually, when you think, when you're watching it, it's like really, really, it's so tightly edited and so nicely directed. And because it's almost entirely on location as well, it gives it really, really an amazing sense of place, an amazing sense of like isolation. And it's like genuinely like really full on and intense. And of course, it's got the one liners and stuff. But Predator's a movie which is absolutely like a satire of like action cinema, apart from anything. Or maybe not a satire, perhaps a deconstruction, shall we say. And like all of that kind of like one liner macho crap, is the whole point of it, is to build it up like that. And then basically just deconstructed, but and by the end it's like all the toys have gone away, all the clothes are off.
Yeah, first the toys and then literally, the clothes.
Yeah, and then it's just a human and an alien just naked wrestling in the woods, and that's all you need. And I watch it and I just think it just never needed any sequels or prequels.
Well, I'm happy that there was a Predator 2, don't get me wrong. The other ones, well, actually, and Prey I enjoyed, but everything else in between.
Yeah, I mean, they're fine, but they're so far from being anywhere near as good as the original. It's like, it's not even. Yeah, so, I don't know. It holds up, definitely. So if you have the opportunity, and it's a good transfer, because famously the Blu-ray transfer was terrible.
Oh, really?
It was a famously bad transfer with like hair all over it and stuff. It's like the VHS had been copied onto DVD, and then they'd copy the DVD onto the Blu-ray.
Laserdisc. Well, because I've said this to you, when you went to see it, but the unveiling of the Predator when he takes the mask off in front of him and they literally get into hand-to-hand combat is probably one of my favorite scenes in cinema. Like when I think about it, I get the same tingles I think of as in I always forget the name of the film. I watched it with you, and I found it a really powerful scene in the David Lynch
Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, Mulholland Drive. That's in the is it Silencio? Not Silencio. Whatever that club is called.
Is it called Club Silencio?
Could be.
I think it is.
It is now. Yeah. Like that sense of like when I think about how I felt at that time, it was like, well, that was actually a really powerful moment. But in Predator, it's just because when he takes
very
the
different
hand
scenes,
off, very different scenes. When he takes the as like the whole thing as like sort of the gas is escaping as he's unclipping it, and I still get that sense of it's just so well done, the way it's such a silent scene. And then when he drops the mask and does that, sort of spreads his arms and does that roar, it's so threatening.
So screwed.
And you realize on, he's like, oh my God. And it's just, everything about it. And then of course it's even got the comedy, like when he punches him and he kind of does that like that's nothing.
Yeah.
And just like, hammers him. Gauging the, like, okay, if that's what you got. And I just think it's like such a brilliant scene. Anyway, so that's good. I'm glad it holds up really well.
It does hold up. And also technically it holds up because, of course, like, it doesn't really have any trashy special effects or anything or visual effects in it. Like, the actual effect of the Predator, like, being camouflaged is still cool stuff. I know the heat vision's become a bit of a cliche, but...
Yes. Yeah, was the one I watched the other day, Wolf Manor. Yes, that used a touch of the old heat vision. The same, that same like sound effect as well. It's like, surely not. That I talk about a film later on, actually, that's going to referencing better films is just it constantly proves it's a no-no. But with them, what was I going to say as well? With I've lost my train of thought now. Sorry. Yeah, but with the, what was I going to say?
Sounds
amazing. Heat vision. Oh yes, the special effects. I was going to say it's the same as, like, for me, like in Highlander, the sort of the blue lightning and sort of like firework effects when they clash swords. It's still, because it's practical, it still all holds up.
And of course, the ultimate in special effects holding up is Little Shop of Horrors with Rick Moranis. That film has the most unbelievable special effects, and I think I saw that when I was in school. I have a vague idea of how they did it as well now, because it's always impressive how, like, because it's obviously a full size puppet, like as big as a person, but it they managed to like move it extremely quickly. And it's like, how do they do that without stop motion sort of thing? And apparently what they did was all the actors, when they're in the shot with it, just moved really slowly around it. And then they sped up the footage. And it's incredible. So that's what gives it the effect of speaking really fast. And so it's a really cool concept. And I still love practical effects, is because of stuff like that. Because it's like, you just wouldn't need to do that with CGI or whatever. But they had to think of their way around it back then. So,
The constant problem solving. Also, just worth a quick mention is the fact that I think it was through Lee in our WhatsApp group that sent a picture of Ernie Hudson now at 78.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
He could literally be 40. It's unbelievable. I couldn't stop looking at the picture and having a looking at the picture. I couldn't stop looking at the picture and with my hands on my legs.
My trousers on.
Firmly buckled, two belts. I just thought, like, you're 78. Like, that's astonishing. Then you look at Dan Aykroyd, and he just looks like Ernie Hudson's elbow.
We'll talk more about those two actors shortly.
Will we?
Mm. We will.
So, people just look at pictures of Ernie Hudson. It's astonishing.
That's our advice for today.
Good. Bye, everyone. And also, I watched Blood Simple because obviously M. Emmett Walsh is, I'm just going to say finally, quite frankly, finally passed away, because he was an old man. I think he was 93.
Yeah, he was looking pretty old back in Blade Runner, to be honest.
And I was going to ask you we'll talk about it later on when I talk about Blood Simple, but he in that film is astonishing. Like, what he brings to that film is quite mesmerizing. And I think I want to watch, because he's always just pops up in films, doesn't he?
He's the consummate character actor, isn't he? Yeah, but I think, who was it? Someone made a point about it. The guy who made Knives Out. What's his name? What's his face?
Ryan Philippe?
Ryan Johnson. made the point that, he wasn't really a leading man type thing, but everything he was in, he was memorable. He was one of them, which I suppose is the ultimate kind of testament to quality character actor, really. But Blade Runner, he's such an odd performance, but like he's got very few lines in Blade Runner, but he's so memorable when just the way he delivers his lines and the way he looks at Harrison Ford is really odd, but just works perfectly. And yeah, and of course it was just nice that he was working till the end of his life.
Like, yeah, I feel like I might have to watch more films with. He's one of those characters, like you say, that when he pops up on screen, if you're not expecting him in the film, your brain instantly thinks good.
Yes,
like this film just got better.
Well, obviously he's in Red Scorpion with Dolph Lundgren as well, so don't worry about that. Gives an excuse to watch that.
Bloody hell! I'm too busy watching Red Sonja on repeat, unfortunately. another question, a little bit more broad, and maybe the listeners can message us on Twitter at The Men Who Talk or The Men Who Talk at Outlook.com. I went through a phase recently where I realised, and I was talking to my brother about this earlier on, that I just, for about 3 weeks, because it's been about 3 weeks since the last episode we did, I just kind of fell out of love with movies. I don't know what it was. Well, actually, I know what it was. Because I was thinking, oh, I just don't fancy watching them. I fancy playing games or like reading, and I've read a few books and stuff. But I looked at the last few films I watched, right? And I thought, no, actually, it doesn't make sense that I just want to knock films on the head, right? Mind Cage, Wolf Manor, The Lost City, Who's Harry Crumb, Wrongfully Accused, and Spaceman. So you can see why I was like, maybe films aren't for me. But
yes, I do recall the last episode being pretty rough on the
on the quality front. But bizarrely enough, the film that got me back into it was because I've hurt my elbow, so I've been out of actions for a bit. I'm quite limited, so I watched a film which I completely reignited my passion for movies, and it's called Champion Killer, and it was so bewilderingly bad that Faye was supposed to make quite an important phone call at the start of this film, and she was so mesmerized by like what was happening that she ended up like missing the phone call because she kept on. I said, "Shouldn't you gotta make that call?" And she was like, "I can't stop watching this." And then
don't you want the medical results?
Yeah, no, there's no time for that now. And she was every now and again, just to my left, she would just say things like, "Can you rewind that?" Or "Why are they doing that?" And I said, "I know, it's brilliant, isn't it? This is," and it completely reinvigorated my love for the cinema I go for, which is 10p ones in a charity shop. So yeah, but I just wondered if it ever happened to you where you just thought, oh, I just don't fancy watching films, but which is quite a bad sign considering we run a movie podcast, in all fairness.
It is really. Yes, although I don't think it's unique to films. I think it's just like any kind of, like I feel the same way about games sometimes. About TV all of the time. like certainly before, like I had a kid and I had a lot more spare time, I basically all my hobbies were either watching movies or playing games. So I there'd be times when I would fall out of love with one or the other, but like you say, something would always bring me back in and remind me of like the beauty of the medium. And then and then it's like, oh, right, okay, now we're back.
Well,
and
in my case, it's the beauty of the extra large, but I kind of get your point.
Yeah, sure. Yes, so I don't think there's ever been an extended period, probably, of not watching movies, I wouldn't say. I think it's always been there. But, with video games, I remember very much falling out of love with video games around the time of like The Last of Us and a bunch of, you know, that there was a bunch of like very cinematic type games, which are really drab. And I was like, oh, I'm not enjoying it. There's just a gameplay here. I don't care about these characters. I'm playing a game for the game. And it got relentless. And I was just like, oh, but then I played Super Mario 3D World on the Wii U, of all things, and it reignited my love for video games. It reminded me of what video games could be, and you know, got back into it. Thank you, Wii U.
On the subject, oh, go on.
I was just going to mention, like, just quickly mention, I am watching a TV show at the moment, like a lot of other people watching Fallout, the TV series on Amazon Prime, and I watched the first four episodes so far.
Yeah.
yeah, it's pretty good. I'm enjoying it. So
oh, I'm glad you're. I'm sure yes, it is, but unfortunately, it's not a movie.
No, it is only 8 episodes, and I will say it hasn't yet fallen into the trap of not justifying itself as a TV show, like as in, you know, where you get like aimless subplots and like just redundant scenes just to pad it out. It's kept it pretty fresh so far, and it's incredibly respectful to the material, or it just feels like it basically just feels like Fallout 3, really. So that's fine. It's a lot of, you know, without it just being endless bobbleheads and stuff. I think there's a slight overuse of Ink Spots era music, perhaps, a little bit. But other than that, yeah. And of course, Walton Goggins is in it.
Whom you fancy. Yeah, I think I'll probably watch it because Faye is drawn to it. She loves the Fallout games, and I think that she's going to... I say she loves the Fallout games. She likes the first one and thinks everything else is shit. No, she does like the Fallout games and the correct response. And I think she'll watch it, and I'm intrigued enough to kind of watch it with her. But it's not something I would just chuck on. Speaking of ancient...
And it's incredibly violent but largely comedic, which is quite essential to the games. So, yes, sorry, go on.
Oh no, just as in talking about ancient history, I don't know when I'll actually get around to doing it, but I've been re-listening to our podcast from the very first episode to get like a highlight reel for YouTube, and I've been like making notes of bits I want to take out, and a few things tickled me, and I'm not going to go into them because there were some points when I actually had to pause because it was just making me laugh, and it's just some of the films we've watched. Bloody hell. But anyway, it was just tickling me because I was talking in it about one of the episodes I was listening to it, like really early on, about what are called screen life horrors. You know, the films like Host and things like that, where it's all done through like a webcam or whatever, like POV stuff.
Yes.
It tickled me because at the time we didn't know what the genre was, so we just called them Gerald Lancasters. And it would just tickle me because like a couple of episodes later, we're like, oh, I watched a Gerald Lancaster. And it just tickled me. And we created something that I kind of feel we should bring back as well, apart from the search for a good Don the Dragon Wilson film, which started in episode 11 4 years ago. But
fruitless enterprise.
When I watched Devil in the Woods, starring Stephen Moyer of True Blood fame, we came up with the six tests? Kind of like Mark Kimmel's like six laugh tests, but if like they're so bad it's good. If a film makes you question it more, six times or more, then it's kind of worth it. So that was proved in Champion Killer, and also proved again for Murder on Raven's Ridge, which I'll talk about later on. But it's time for the meat of the podcast, Rupert. It's time for movies.
Yes,
I've got six. But a lot of these are TMTs, 2-minute trashings,
okay.
and one of them I didn't watch all the way through. So
didn't even press play.
Before we kick off, I wouldn't mind going first just because I want to get this out of the way. Have you seen the new Roadhouse?
No, I have not. It doesn't really appeal to me because it looks very different to the original. And at the same time, I'm like, well, I mean, the original wasn't that good. and it had Sam Elliott, which this one hasn't got. So I don't know. The reasons to watch are falling away. Are you going to give me reasons to watch it?
I will. I don't want to sway you either way. I'll just tell you what I thought of it, and then you can take it away. So like you said, this is a remake of the 1989 film with Patrick Swayze and Sam Brit fancies me Elliot. He's in the bar. He's got shares in the bar. He's behind the bar. He's reflected in every window in the bar. And so I when I was a few people said that this was really good and they really enjoyed it. And I thought, well, you know, I'll watch it. I mean, I like the original, but as we've commented on many times in this podcast, you and I both can quite easily just disassociate remakes from the original, like, it doesn't impinge my enjoyment of the original. It doesn't bother me. So I kind of made a mental decision. I just thought, oh, do you know what? I'm just going to watch this on its own merit. I really like Jake Gyllenhaal, and I'm happy to just watch it as on its own merit sort of thing. And I'm not going to think this is a remake of Roadhouse, because Roadhouse is a film I do like, and I've watched it quite a lot over the years. So the main plot is that his name is Elwood Dalton, Jake Gyllenhaal, and he sort of makes a living by going to underground fights and going up to the champion and sort of putting down big bets. Going up and revealing who he is just before the fight takes place. And because he's a sort of a really well-respected UFC fighter, they usually just pack it in and say, nah, you can have the money, mate. I'm not fighting you, because they think he's just going to kick the shit out of him. Bizarrely, the first person that when the film starts, I think his name is Post Malone.
Another bit of stunt casting. Okay, he's like a musician, isn't he?
I think it's Post Malone. I might be wrong, but it's someone who covered in tattoos, who's basically
Of the look, right? Okay.
Yeah, he's basically got like my physique as well, because he's covered in tattoos. He's like slightly pudgy, and in the start of it, he's kicking the hell out of this like 6'8" bull, and it's like, really? And then it ties into something that bothered me about the whole film as well. Someone comes up to him. She's got a roadhouse bar in the Florida Keys, and she's like, can you come and be my bouncer, basically, because we've got a lot of trouble with this gang. And he says no, and eventually he sort of decides to do it. And the film is just him integrating himself into the sort of local community, and then it getting into fights, and, you know, Conor McGregor comes in as this sort of psychotic fighter who ends up getting involved in it's the usual thing about, you know, they want to get the land off her, so they're trying to sort of run her out of it so they can buy the land for cheap and build flats or whatever, smuggling dog. And the guy who's behind all this just gets Conor McGregor into trying to basically kick the shit out of Jake Gyllenhaal. I felt like I was watching Amelie when I watched this film, because it was so bright and everything was so sort of like frothy and quirky that it very quickly became grating to me. So there's no sense of the impact of violence. At the start, when Post Malone or whoever it is in these fights, imagine you're in a fight, right? A bare knuckle underground boxing fight. But it's round after round, so you're just taking on all comers. Imagine how tired you'd be after one fight. And then throughout the film, he is shown as like a very capable fighter, Jake Gyllenhaal, Dalton. But it's kind of done for laughs. Like, there's a bit where someone runs up to him at the start and stabs him in the kidney with a knife. And he sort of takes it out like, oh, bloody hell, again. And then... when he gets
he doesn't like surgery and then months of recuperation then.
No, he doesn't drop to his knees vomiting blood and then the whole film is just him in a coma. No, it takes a different turn. So then when the fights kick off, he's obviously so good that when the gang were like hustling them, he's like, oh, how far is the nearest hospital from you? 20 minutes. Okay, you might want to book a taxi kind of thing before he gets into the fight with him. And he's constantly quipping. He's constantly really cheerful. And every single character is quirky. Like the woman who hires him is like sort of, you know, a bit of a bitch with a heart of gold. There's a little girl who runs a bookstop with a dad who's bit quirky. And then all of the members of the gang have their little quirky personalities. Dalton's quite quirky in that, you know, he's quite upbeat, but he's an extremely violent man. The bar patrons are all a little bit zany, and it was very irritating. And also, it balances all this sort of like almost like knee slapping, like little, like it was written by Joss Whedon, sort of vibe with like extreme violence, but in a way that just didn't work, because I just didn't believe when it kind of started getting darker and the stakes raised, I thought, well, this all seems really like silly fun. So why would I care now? And what happened was I was watching it and it got to about an hour in and Faye fell asleep, and I was there with a full glass of wine, and I didn't have to get up in the morning, and I thought, I think I'd just rather get an extra hour's kip than watch this. I just completely drained me of all my enthusiasm. And that's not to, because it's a, apart from the premise, it's a very, it's not a very different film. It's just a much worse film if you compared it to Roadhouse, because there's, it's not, it, when I watched Seven Psychopaths, I remember thinking, this is a film that is trying to show me how smart and funny it is, as opposed to actually being funny and smart. And with this, I got the same vibe, like everyone was having much more fun than I was. And I really like Jake Gyllenhaal, and I'm sure it's a totally fine film for some people to just think, oh yeah, it was a good laugh, that was, and Conor McGregor's in it. You know, he doesn't embarrass himself in it. But I just think, well, I don't care, because I'm so bored by the film and the never-ending quirkiness and zaniness of everything going on that I just didn't want to watch it. It just kind of irritated me out of the room. So wow. I have no interest in watching this again.
It doesn't sound a lot like the original, which I suppose is to be applauded on one level, but because the original was quite sober, really, wasn't it? I mean, it was kind of cheesy, but it wasn't wacky, zany, kind of like it, and he was very serious, I seem to remember. Like, that was the whole thing. He came in and like cleaned up the place by being like a very serious leader, sort of thing. Oh, that doesn't sound very appealing.
No, I just didn't enjoy it at all. I don't, to the point that I haven't even gone on Wikipedia to see like what happened. I'd lost that much interest. I said, I just don't care about this, actually.
Is Conor McGregor bearable? Because I find it quite unbearable in real life, so I don't know how it would translate.
I don't know much about him. I assume he's a fist, but I'll tell you all you need to know about how he's introduced, right? So when the quirky crime boss and his quirky henchmen threaten the quirky bar patrons, then they get Conor McGregor, who's again another wacky dude. He is obviously having
massively high on coke, probably.
The way they introduce him is he is naked and in a room having sex, and like, I guess the woman's, they're in like Portugal or something, woman's wife, her husband comes home, and he jumps down off the balcony naked, and he's walking through the streets like smiling at everyone, and they're all looking at his tip, obviously. And then he goes into a market, it's at nighttime, and he sees a guy wearing a cool suit, and then it fades out. And then when it fades back in, the market's on fire, and he's just like, the guy's holding his nose, and he's got the suit on, walking off.
Right.
And it's one, look how hard he is. Oh, that was fun, wasn't it? Too much. That was kind of when I started to reel it. My enthusiasm really grew. So yeah, I don't think he speaks, so I didn't see him speak. But
it's for the best.
Maybe they limited his dialogue for that reason, sort of thing. But yeah, it wasn't for me.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Let's not watch that. Okay, well, let me quickly do a cinema release. This is a rarity, isn't it?
Arcadis, yeah.
No. Ghostbusters, Frozen Empire. So this is following on from the previous film, Afterlife, and now the family, which was introduced in that film, and now includes Paul Rudd as the de facto stepfather. They've moved to New York City and into the actual Ghostbusters buyer house, which is financed by a wealthy philanthropist named, yes, Winston Zeddemore. Meanwhile, a clueless internet salesman played by Kumail Nanjiani flogs this magic orb to a shop owner specializing in the paranormal, played by, yes, Dan Aykroyd. Is actually Ray Stantz as well. And through various contrivances, this special orb ends up in Winston Zeddemore's secret Ghostbuster research facility. It turns out the orb contains the spirit of a monster with the power to freeze stuff really quickly. And it kind of acts like those scientifically dubious, like, freezing scenes in The Day After Tomorrow. Anyway, it ends up with this new Ghostbuster family teaming up with the original cast again, plus a couple of other characters, plus this internet salesman guy for a showdown in Manhattan. Now, I hated Afterlife because it's relentless and lazy, cheap fan service, and it's boring setting, and it's like failed attempts to be a PG-13 Stranger Things, and it's completely shameless Deus Ex Machina, and it's weirdly tasteless resurrection of Harold Ramis.
But apart from that, it was a blinder.
But other than that, it's bloody brilliant. I do think A Frozen Empire is marginally better, although that's like comparing Hitler and Himmler, really, isn't it? It's like the fan service is still very tiresome and distracting. So that is a problem. But the main problem, which is a broad problem, is the film is like 30% too much of everything. Like it's like 30 minutes too long. There's sort of like 30% too many jokes. There are too many characters, too many scenes, too many subplots. And I'll expand on some of these, because the too many jokes thing is a problem because it unbalances the horror comedy dynamic, and it means that the stakes are reduced because every event is just careening towards a punchline. But the bigger problem is too many characters, because that feeds into everything else. And this is the biggie, because by the end of this movie, there are literally 10 or more Ghostbusters fighting one evil spirit. And even with its already turgid runtime, no one is given sufficient screen time, so it's just unsatisfying for everyone. And it squeezes out potentially interesting characters. So, like, Finn Wolfhard, literally taken from Stranger Things, he actually needn't be in this movie at all. It's not to say that all the performances are bad, but Bill Murray's performance is bad. But then you've got, like, Dan Aykroyd, who brings real energy and commitment to the role, and it's quite lovely. Dan Aykroyd is the standout, particularly of the old cast anyway. And then we get to the too many subplots part. Like I mentioned, Finn Wolfhard, like they don't give him anything to do. They keep cutting back to him, like trying to capture Slimer in the attic. And it's got nothing to do with anything. It's just to include Slimer and give him something to do. It's irrelevant. But the biggest time sink in the film is this subplot, right? Concerning the daughter character, his name I can't remember. Basically, the story is that she's like 14 or whatever, and she's been banned from being a Ghostbuster by Walter Peck because she's a minor. It's not Walter Peck. Is it Walter? Yes, of course it's Walter Peck, yes. And basically she's been banned from being a Ghostbuster because she's a minor. And so we watch her basically mope around and she develops a friendship with this ghost of a teenage girl, right? And these scenes just go on forever. And like an efficient script would have had one scene, okay, in which like the ghost situation was explained and we could work out for ourselves as the audience, like how her purgatory might mirror the daughter's situation. So I think you might see a bit of like equivalence there. Only need one scene for that. But no, they have a second, third, fourth, like boring encounter between these two characters just to hammer it home. And it gives the film this horribly stuttered rhythm and artificially extends this 2-hour runtime. So I think there is a half decent 85 minute cut of this film, but they just went for quantity over quality and there's no way of cutting it down now. They should have ditched a third of the characters, trimmed the script, taken the sign off the writer's wall which said every scene needs to be a direct callback to a 40-year-old film, and then it may have been bearable. But
I'll never watch.
If you disliked Afterlife, then you won't like this. If you loved Afterlife, then maybe you'll love this even more. But I just think it's a dead body, and this one's not coming back to life, this franchise. I'm sure some critic wags made that joke already. Resurrect this one, etc.
I think we mentioned this before, possibly when you talk about the Afterlife in the podcast last year or whatever, but it's a bizarre one, isn't it? Because Ghostbusters is basically one good film and then a load of films are either okay or complete misfires. Like, even if you look outside the medium, like there was kind of a mildly fondly remembered animated series, and then a half decent PS3 game. So it's like, where is this love for like a franchise come from, as opposed to just the first film? Like, I've watched the first one. I mixed the first and second ones up in my mind, but I'm surprised they're getting released now. I don't know what. Like, I'm sure maybe some people, like, you know, the next generation, maybe like teenagers and kids now will think we'll click with it. Maybe we're just so not the target audience, kind of like the Ebola. What was the Ebola? Enola Holmes, whatever that was called, with Billy Ray Cyrus in it. But I just think
that... Oh, you mean Billy Zane?
Sorry, what did I say? Walter Matthau, Billy Bobby Brown in it. These films just come and go for me. There's so many other films I'd rather watch, like Champion Killer, that they have no impact on me at all. Like,
I think they're just aimed at 40 something men. I can't think of another reason why they resurrect Ghostbusters, because, like, I don't know, maybe I'm clueless, but like, if you watch Ghostbusters as a young person now, you probably find it immensely dated, and I don't know, some like the sexual politics a bit questionable, but I don't think, I mean, it's got some charm in it, but I mean, it's not, it hasn't really, it's quite dated in a lot of ways, you know, it's good, but it is quite dated in a lot of ways. And then, yeah, like you say, everything that came after it was just crap. It's just total crap. There hasn't been anything like, mate, we can say, oh, you know, there was like that cool scene in the second one with the Statue of Liberty coming alive, but the film was crap. The TV series, that anime series, was just shit. It was like just standard, like, Saturday morning cartoons, which were all shit at that time. So I don't know what, I don't know where it comes from. I know there was the, there was the Paul Feig one, which is mildly amusing, but it's like, again, it was just a different thing. People didn't want it, so it's like they moved on, and then they went for the Stranger Things angle with like Afterlife, you know, this, and they're crap. So they just got to stop it. And I think this one's not done particularly well at the box office, so they're getting the message.
Yeah,
and like the game wasn't that good. It was all right. I know the one you're talking about, 2009 or whatever, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's all right, isn't it? It's all like, if someone said, do you want to sit down and watch the Ghostbusters animated show, I'd watch it for nostalgic purposes, but I wouldn't seek it out. But yeah, no. I don't. Yeah. Good film, bad franchise. Well, moving on from that then to this is just going to be a really super quick review. I watched one of the three for this episode that I watched, given to me by my brother from a charity shop. And it's called Murder at Raven's Ridge, or just Raven's Ridge. And I knew this was going to be bad because I had to fast forward the intro because the music on the DVD menu that continues over the credits, over POV footage of a car driving around LA, was the worst music I'd ever heard. And I had to just fast forward it. It wasn't as bad as in my tastes. If you imagine this, right? When I watch films, I have it somewhere, the volume on my TV, it's somewhere between 14 and 28, depending on like what the sound mix is like. Yeah. This was on at 12, and the music was like some really quiet drums and then a burst of incredibly loud synthetic guitar. So and then it would just repeat, and I thought, well, I can't get the volume at the right... it was making me jump. It was so fiercely loud and awfully mixed. And it repeated, that motif repeated over the credits. So I thought, well, just fast forward the credits then. And then I realized the film was 70 minutes long, another classic sign. This is from 1999, and I didn't see it, and I wish it was on this. Apparently, on some versions of this DVD, the director, I think I've got his name up. Here it is. So Mike Upton, I've never heard of him. In some releases of this on DVD, there's actually like almost a disclaimer at the start of the film where it shows him sat in a chair and he basically tells you to like bear in mind that it was low budget and everyone involved tried their best.
Oh, he's making excuses for
it. Making excuses for it, yeah. So, but I didn't see that. I just went in blind, and it is extremely boring. The plot is six friends decide to rob an armored truck, bury the money, then go back months later when it's all cooled down, dig it up, split it, and go their own ways. And obviously, it doesn't work out. What actually happens is they do the robbery, they bicker. They go to this place, they bury it, they bicker, they separate, they come back, they bicker, they can't find the money, and then they start getting hunted by like a crazy hillbilly because they've buried it on his land. And the whole film is people bickering. The only moment in this film I thought, was when I recognized one of the people who gets killed off early on was Jorge Garcia from Lost. I was like, oh, he's dead. Okay. It's just incredibly bland. It's just people trudging around like dry brush and like sort of like open mountain ranges, just getting shot at and like hiding in caves and stuff, and then bickering. And what makes it even worse is at the start, they make a direct reference to Reservoir Dogs.
Okay.
And I thought, right. But yeah, I can't even jazz this up. It's just... It's one of those films as well that from the late 90s where it's in 4:3 ratio, and it just looks on DVD or like on modern TVs, it just looks like a rough cut of a film. You know, some have that vibe, it's just a little bit washed out, and it just looks like you're watching a rough cut, like the dailies. It's just boring. There's just nothing to say about it. It's just flat film like a student film that just needs to be lost. So yeah, don't watch Ravensridge or Murder at Raven's Ridge.
So this was the film that resurrected your love of cinema?
No, that was Champion Killer, which I'll get on to.
Sorry. Yeah. Didn't want to get it wrong. Let's make a start on... I have a series of films to talk about. I think I've already mentioned this. It's American Ninja. Let's just give it to you straight. I watched 5 American Ninja films in a row. So you don't have to.
I'm so happy for you.
And you know what? They're all on Prime except the first one. But then for some reason, it's annoying when they do that. But that's
how
good.
Did you watch the first one then?
I got a temporary free trial of MGM via Prime. So it was on there. It's the only film I watched in that subscription period. Okay, so let's start with American Ninja, the classic original, 1985 canon films. So the story is that the titular American is a private in a very poorly run military compound, which lacks basic discipline. And this routine convoy operation goes wrong, and the American, Michael Dudikoff, is blamed for this debacle. But he discovers that the main oligarch on the island is involved in illegal weapons trading, and the sergeant of the compound is involved. But of course, no one believes him because his name is Mud, and this dealer wants him dead. Thankfully, he has a small army of ninjas at his disposal to take him out. Right. Other details about the plot. So Dudikoff, he's fallen for Colonel's hot daughter, and his only friend is Steve James, another soldier, with whom he develops a strong homoerotic relationship after they have a topless fist fight.
I wish that Steve James was my only friend. Okay.
Well. Yes, we'll get to him. But and of course the backstory to Michael Dudikoff's character. He's basically a blank slate. He's got no history and no next of kin, having suffered amnesia following an explosion or something. But he knows ninja shit because he was raised by a Japanese dude. So I found this to be an oddly sweet-natured film, and it's got this kind of lightness of touch and joy that is lacking in some other military set films of the period. And there's this kind of bloodless A-team innocence about it. It's got similar music in a way, actually, to A-Team, with this like militaristic military drum kind of score. It's lacking synth steel drums, unfortunately, but get them in the next movie, so don't worry. There's this corrupt sergeant character who looks and sounds like he's just walked off the set of NYPD Blue. He's like Dennis Franz or something. It's really miscast. But anyway, so going back to the ninjas, yes, so ninjas after him is basically a series of fights with ninjas. And being a ninja basically seems to mean, in the case of him, it means basically being psychic to your enemy's position and being able to run faster than someone can, like, shift the direction of their automatic rifle. There's like a whole scene where Michael Dudikoff is escaping an enemy facility, and they will get like soldiers strafing him with machine gun fire, and it will cut to back to Dudikoff, and he's just rolling out of the way with the bullets. And Michael Dudikoff, by the way, he cannot act in this. He has literally one expression. And this does cause issues when he's on screen with Steve James, who's naturally very charismatic and energetic.
Yeah.
And it will be an enduring theme throughout these films. Even when Muggle
is there. He's also really, like, sort of softly spoken and quite boyish. So, yeah.
He's got quite a weedy kind of voice and a small face.
Yeah, like a wispy voice.
Yeah. I mean, overall, I'd say that the first film is technically the best one because it has a vague plot and
careful, recycled,
and it's got okay characterization, and it doesn't have so many of these awkward, badly directed dead air character interactions that a lot of the sequels have. But what I will say is the sequels do add a greater, like, frequency of action scenes, and frankly they also offer more violence, which is kind of needed, actually, because when you think about it, Cannon films were up against, like, Jean-Claude Van Damme and Arnie at this point, so they needed to up their game a bit. So the first one is charming, but possibly a bit too light in tone and a bit bloodless, but still, you know, good fun, enjoyable, liked it. So that's number one.
Yeah.
Do I go careering straight into number two?
I think it makes sense that you do, because number two is my absolute favorite of this. So, yeah, I'm keen.
It's not mine, although, we'll see. American Ninja 2, The Confrontation, which is on Prime. This one's set on a nameless Caribbean island. So we'll call it Valverde. And it starts with some Marines getting beaten and captured in a bar. And one of the Marines is a scheming little son of a bitch. So Dudikoff and James rock up on the island. They're not Marines, they're army men. They meet the naughty Marine guy from the first scene, who takes them to an army base, even more ill-disciplined than the first film, frankly, where they just hang out drinking, playing volleyball, and making misogynistic comments mostly. So anyway, so Dudikoff and James, they're here to investigate these missing Marines while keeping a low profile. So good luck with that. So they travel to various islands and have slapstick fights in dive bars and end up infiltrating the bad guy's high security lab, which will become an unshakable trope in this series. So by this point in the series, any attempt at an orchestral score are completely gone. And now, yes, we do have, like, sub James Horner synth-based steel drums on the soundtrack because of the exotic location, obviously. So, now, most of the back half of this movie, which is the assault on the bad guy's base, it looks like it was filmed in Mandy Leisure Centre in Cardiff. It's astonishing. Just, like, really drab. Like,
I've got a lot to say about the ending sequence, but just to clarify, because I've seen this film a lot, but always a bit drunk and a few years ago now. Is this the one where when he gets to the sort of villain's compound at the end, he kills a ninja and steals his clothes, but you know it's him because he happens to steal the ninja's clothing, the only ninja there who's got a blue-coloured sash so you can tell them apart from the other ninjas.
I believe that is, yes. Yeah. For our benefit more than anyone's. Yeah. I think this is more fun than the first one because the buddy pairing is kind of established now, and you've got, and it actually works quite nicely because you've got Steve James' very charismatic approach bouncing off Dudikoff's like straight arrow, and Dudikoff seems more relaxed and a bit more human in this one. And on top of that, Steve James gets to do way more fighting, and it always involves him just ripping his top off and just making one-liners between bad guys. So that's
he
awesome.
He has been to the gymnasium, that man.
Yes, yes. He seems absolutely comfortable removing his clothing, and I'm comfortable with it too. So, and this is also, I suppose, arguably, this improves on the first one insofar as actually get to see some ninja tactics. They're not just completely useless people in pajamas. Like, there's a cool bit where they're on a beach, obviously, and like Marco Dudikoff's on like a rock, and he's thinking they can't get to me. And then they kind of like, these ninjas run towards a rock and make like a human ladder to get up there, which I thought was pretty cool. So it's like, oh, they're actually doing something which ninjas may be trained to do rather than just for just getting beaten up by Marco Dudikoff. It's poorly filmed and poorly edited, and the script is obviously not great, but I would say that this is the sweet spot in terms of consistent action and the James Dudikoff pairing, because things will change from here on.
Can I just say a couple of things before you move on? If that's cool about this, the ending sequence, the way this ending sequence kicks off is after that car chase where they find the compound and stuff, and they find out where it is. And I remember the girl, they sat down on like a sand dune, and they have this sort of conversation, this sort of quiet conversation. And she says, oh, yeah, so now all we have to do is like radio the camp and tell Steve James and everyone where it is, and then get the police involved, and they can just go over there and they can arrest them all. And Michael Dudikoff says, no, I'm just going to go over there myself, I think. And she says, really? He just does it. And also, the way, what sticks with me about this as well is the way the main bad guy was not building an army of ninjas, Rupert, but super ninjas. The way he demonstrates them to the waiting clients, like their sort of how their abilities, is he gets the man who's trained them all to kill them systematically very easily. And he sort of says, see? And I thought, you've just shown that they're not very good at fighting. These are invested.
Because like in all of these, in basically from number two onwards, is always like an evil bad guy and he's showing off to investors, basically. And it's not... This same thing happens again in, I think, the fourth one. But yeah, it's like, oh, here you go. This is, look at these super ninjas. And it's like one dude, non-super ninja, kicking the shit out of them. It's like, oh.
I don't know. Well, yeah, it's like a really dodgy plot point. But yes, go on. So this is my favorite, although I haven't seen five. So I'm intrigued how this is going to carry on.
All right. Well, we'll continue into American Ninja 3, Blood Hunt, which is a bit of a weird... I'm not sure what that blood hunt means. Like,
they're hunting for blood, aren't they?
Well, you'd think blood would be pretty easy to find. You've got like 6 liters of it in your body. But yeah, okay. It's called Blood Hunt. Anyway, in this one, the bad guys, yes, they're creating genetically engineered super soldiers, which they intend to sell to the Saudis or something. And to achieve their aims, they need prime human specimens. So they use a karate tournament to choose their lucky winner. Okay, yes. Michael Dudikoff sat this one out, but thankfully we still have Steve James, because the most expressive thing about the other actors in this movie is their hair. And you still have the synthesized steel drums, so don't worry. This film, by the way, it should have been called American Ninja 3 post-dubbing, because they must have spent weeks in the studio after this one, just astonishing every line. So the backstory here is the main guy, I can't remember his name, David Bradley?
Yes.
Yeah, the Michael Dudikoff replacement. The main guy, he's been raised by this Izuma, a ninja master, since the killing of his father. So it's basically the same shit as the previous one. So the fight scenes in this one, they are dominated by the feeblest ninjas you've ever seen. They're just completely incompetent thugs. At least there was an attempt in the first two to give them some mystique or some unique skills, but no. This one has an underwater fist fight scene, which is always hilarious. He manages to gain sufficient purchase, right, underwater, bear in mind, to knock out two dudes by punching them in the chest and killing them both instantly. Underwater. The main bad guy, his right hand woman, is named
American Ninja 3, sufficient purchase.
The main bad guy's woman is called Chan Lee, which I quite like. This is the one where there's a point at which, right, so at one point Steve James he's speaking to the chief of police, right? And the chief of police makes a threatening comment to him. And Steve James replies, "I resemble that remark." Now, what he actually means is, "I resent that remark," of course. Yeah, but I rewound it because I thought, surely he did. He says, "I resemble that remark." It's even in the subtitles. He literally said the wrong word. It's unbelievable. There is quite a cool stunt where someone lands a paraglider on the back of a moving truck. So that's cool. So, and actually, I've got to say, you know, there's obviously physical stunts throughout all these movies, not hugely like elaborate ones, but it's really cool just to see physical stunts really. And for all its shoddiness and bad dialogue and dumb plotting, it is relentless in terms of action, really relentless, this one. There's also a scene where like the main guy flies into the bad guy's laboratory using a paraglider. Flies into the bad guy's laboratory, right? Breaks in, kills several of his men before finally being subdued. And when he comes around, he asks the bad guy, "Oh, why did your men attack me?" It's like, "Well, why did you just literally infiltrated my base and started murdering my staff?" they hook up with this they hook up with this Japanese burner with a terrible hair towards the end. And she literally heals the main guy with magic by waving her hands under his chin.
Actual magic.
Actual magic has been introduced into this.
100% Paul Daniels.
Yeah, it suddenly goes Paul Daniels at that point. And I'm pretty sure it ends up in the same leisure center as the second film.
Really?
I think so. I think it's literally the same one. I think it's Mandy Leisure Center in Cardiff. So yeah, that's number three. Any questions?
They're all kind of
blended to one, really.
Is it three? No, they don't, because two stands out. But is it three or four where he's on like a dock, like a boating dock, and he's looking at a load of shipping containers, and then it cuts back to him, and he sort of squints, and then when it cuts back, there's about 50 ninjas there, like they've just appeared from magic.
Oh, I think that is the third one. I know the bit you're talking about. Yeah, they really do. Because it is genuinely difficult to differentiate them, because it's not like, even though they're different actors, but literally the plot is the same every single time. And the quality is basically the same every single time. It might as just be a single movie, just watch it all the way through like a Lord of the Rings medley with more ninjas. American Ninja 4, : The Annihilation. This one brings back Michael Dudikoff, but it dispenses with Steve James.
I know.
The story is here that a bunch of soldiers have been kidnapped by an anti-American nutcase, this time a Brit, and... not you. Who's demanding a ransom of $50 million? Seems quite low, actually. But anyway, to be paid in X number of days, or he'll burn them alive, naturally. And Michael Dudikoff is wheeled out of retirement, because he's a teacher now, obviously. He's got to go and save him. He's wearing a t-shirt tucked into beltless stonewashed jeans, and he he basically teams up with the cast of Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome to storm this bad guy's palace. I'd say palace. It has like pale blue and white walls, single glazing, echoey corridors lit with fluorescent bulbs. And in some ways, you'd be forgiven thinking it may, in fact, be mainly leisure centre in Cardiff. Tonally, it is a bit different to the previous movies because this one's much meaner and definitely more violent. Like the main bad guy is really vicious.
Well, you can tell it's meaner because of David Bradley's expression on the cover. He's frowning.
It's slightly better acted, directed, shot and edited than number three, so that's good. No steel drums, and actually it's got quite a pleasing ambient synth score on this one, so that's good.
Just
look it up. There's this point at which, like, he's captured by the bad guy. I can't even remember whether it's David Bradley or Tudikov. No, it's Bradley, because he's the one who's captured. He's captured by the bad guy because he's a threat, right? Mm-hmm. And then the bad guy tries to make an example of him by having his ninjas beat him up. But of course, all this does is prove that he's a threat, because he ends up beating up all the ninjas, and then it just proves what he already knew. So it's like, he captured him because he's a threat, set his ninjas on him, who all get beaten up, and then it's like, you see, he's a threat. And it's like, well, that just wasted a load of ninjas, didn't it? Just wasted a load of ninjas. There's no logic to this. Again, another display, another flawed display of another self-defeating display of might.
Weirdly, on Wikipedia for this one, I can't click on the director Cedric Sundström's name. Almost like this is the only thing he's ever done. That's bizarre. That is.
I actually think this film's got. We're on number four now. I actually think this is not a bad three-act structure, because basically you get the new guy. With Bradley.
Oh, you've gone silent on me.
Oh, are you still alive?
Oh, hang on.
Hang on, a cotton picking minute.
Yeah. I'm glad we kept a moment of silence then. You dropped out. The last thing I heard you say was talking about Cedric Sundström, and you said this film, and then it completely cut out. So do you want to go back to that bit?
This film is amazing. No, this film, actually, it hasn't got a bad three-act structure. So you've got the new guy, Bradley. So you focus on him at the start, and then you focus on Dudikoff. And then in the final third, it's like the two team up. David Bradley might feel a little bit aggrieved at spending a third of the film chained up in a prison cell, but still. I've no idea where they're meant to be in this film, by the way. There are beaches, forests, open fields, deserts. The one thing, though, I've noticed at this point is that the one thing there's very little of in throughout all these films is darkness, which does beg the question, why do these ninjas keep dressing in black in broad daylight in like forests? It doesn't really make sense. Right. So anyway, there's a scene where to gain entry to the bad guy's base, Michael Dudikoff goes up to a large metal grating embedded in concrete and just tears it off the wall. And it harkens back to Ronnie Cox escaping a prison in Captain America, not that one. There's a scene where Michael Dudikoff is being held from behind, right? And someone in front of him shoots a crossbow at him. Michael Dudikoff turns his head and catches the bolt mid-flight in his teeth, right? So he's got the bolt in his teeth, okay? And he manages to turn his head with such ferocity, he manages to produce sufficient purchase to thrust the bolt into the guy's head, into the guy's throat behind him. And then I thought, that's ridiculous on its face anyway. But also, why? Right, if you had the speed and foresight...
This is literally American Ninja 4 sufficient purchase too.
Yeah. If you had the speed and foresight, right, to move and catch a crossbow bolt in your teeth, couldn't you just move your head slightly out of the way and allow it to kill the guy behind you? Because if you move, then it's going to hit him anyway. Why catch it in your teeth, then kill him by like shoving it into his neck? So that makes sense.
Brilliant. That's probably the most ridiculous minor sequence. Yeah, that's astonishing. That's wonderful.
And this film has a weirdly unsatisfying ending. Like, you've seen this bad guy, really vicious bad guy, like murder and torture multiple people, and then he just like gets beaten unconscious at the end. Like, I feel like that's a flaw in the film language here. You need him to like explode or something. You know, you need something. You need something kind of
not that they just trip him up and kick him until he falls asleep. Yeah, that's.
Oh, we'll get to some of that in the next one. Don't you worry about that. Am I just going to go straight into five?
Yes, of course. I'm not a stupid man. Of course you are.
American Ninja 5. I don't think it actually has a subtitle. Anyway, we're up to 1993 now. It's canon again.
The year that Steve James sadly passed away.
Yeah. So it is canon films again, although this one was originally titled American Dragons because it wasn't meant to be American Ninja. David Bradley returns, except he's not playing the same character he played in the last two movies, but someone else.
What's that? Right.
Someone with marginally more charisma, thankfully. I mean, the fact that it makes absolutely no difference, the fact that he's a different character, is something of an indictment against the last couple of movies, I guess. But... oh, yeah. There's a scene in this film where the bad guy like refers to the American. Right. And it cuts away and they just add the word ninja in post dubbing because he clearly just said the American and they just cut away and they just want to add ninja to make it clear that, yes, it's an American ninja film. Anyway, the bad guys this time around are developing some kind of killer gas and they have 2 days to deliver it to some corrupt army general. So, yeah, it's another bad guy with big ideas. Limited time frame, scientific lab, etc. David Bradley is living an idyllic life on a small boat in Key West in Florida. And one day his sensei, played by Pat Morita, asks him to look after his 12-year-old nephew, right? And possibly teach him some karate. So David Bradley's got this kid under his wing, a kid who likes nothing more than ogling girls.
This is the film I've seen this. Because you remember, this is the one where Pat Morita says in a middle of a basketball court, can you look after him? And he says yes. And then he disappears in a cloud of smoke. It's actual magic. Yeah, I have times. Seen this. Yeah, he's constantly playing his Game Gear. Yes, I've seen this. Yeah. Yes.
I was thinking, oh, is it an Atari Lynx? Oh, no, because you can't turn it upside down and play it left-handed, can you? So he asks him to teach him a bit of karate. So David Bradley, he teaches this kid ninjutsu in literally a 30-second montage, by the way. And it's not even a montage. It's a single silhouette shot, in fact. So it's not even a montage. Actual magic, yes, in this one. There's a point at which it's not just, I mean, the smoke thing you could probably argue is, oh, you know, it's just a bit of like, smoke and mirrors type thing. But actually in this, they conjure the spirit of Pat Morita just through intense concentration, right? The kid and David Bradley. And he has separate conversations with each of them at the same time. The main bad guy can conjure himself from thin air. Now, instead of just using this ability to just conjure himself out of thin air to kill David Bradley, he just uses it to introduce yet more lousy henchmen. So there's a lot of things that don't make sense about this film. Like the scientist guy is conducting all of this like cutting edge scientific research completely on his own. He's like, he's a captive, and so he's got to do this for the bad guy. But he's the father of the burner who David Bradley wants to be with. Very convenient. Right. Yeah, there are two main henchmen in this film, and both of whom are dispatched in unusual ways, shall we say. The first one, they end up in this, I don't know if you remember, they end up in this deadly gas chamber, right? The good guys and the bad guys. And they've all got like gas masks on, but this main henchman is like killed when he like he's running towards the good guys and he trips over a dog, lands on his face, and his gas mask cracks, and he dies.
he trips over a dog.
Yeah.
How is the and dog not dead? Is the dog dead, I assume, because of the gas?
It's like a scientific research dog, but it's like, that was unsatisfying. And then the final henchman is killed on a plane because David Bradley throws a wad of burning tissue at him and he falls out of the plane.
You're going to have to explain that more fully, I think.
It's something like... I can't remember the reason. There's a reason why they can create fire out of something. So, of course, he's like, in order to, like,
kill him, he
sets fire to... yeah, some crap like that. But I just thought, that's just a bit of burning tissue. He's just lobbed it at him. That's something I'd try out of desperation because I don't want to get punched.
That is amazing. Also, that's up there with Gina Hackman at the end of French Connection 2, knackeredly jogging alongside a slow-moving yacht.
Also, in that final sequence, because they're on this plane, this 12-year-old kid, right, he learns to fly a plane in literally seconds, and presumably lands it somewhere. Where? Who knows? But it's unbelievable. This one is, number five is, it's probably the most different to the other films in terms of tone, although of course it does retain that oft-repeated plot.
Does he learn to fly it quicker than Arnie does in Commando?
Possibly. I mean, I suppose you could at least argue that Arnie is an adult and he may have operated some heavy machinery before. Well, I just have some idea. Like, he's not 12.
Have you felt the weight of a Game Gear, mate, with six batteries in? Double A's?
I was just thinking about that. I wonder, maybe I'm just forgetting. Maybe there's some reference. Like, maybe
he's playing, Top Gun. He's playing Top Gun on it. No, he's playing Top Gun on it because I remember seeing the screen.
So that's it. That's the explanation. Brilliant. Perfect. Absolutely watertight. So five is very enjoyable because it's so ridiculous. But overall, all of the films are enjoyable. And I'd say they absolutely epitomize canon films. I think like they're so canon. And I suppose it's kind of the story of canon, almost like mid-80s to, well, almost mid-90s when PM Entertainment could take over. I would say that the third film is probably the low point just because it's so badly made. And it's got so many of those, like I was saying, those dead air scenes where it's just like, characters in like medium shot having slightly awkward conversations, almost like either they're rehearsing or they're improvising, which sounds unlikely given the nature of the film. But yeah, that was particularly bad, but they're all enjoyable and I'd happily watch every single one of them again. Even the fifth one, you know, even though it's clearly not an American Ninja film, still fits because it's just a template from the previous films. It's fine. Absolutely fine.
So you would say, if you had to put them in order of enjoyment, what would they be?
Pure enjoyment? Ooh, that's a tricky one. I really did enjoy the last one because it was so... Number five, because it was so ridiculous. Like, everything that happened was like, why? You know, they were saying the what test?
The six-watt test, yeah.
So I'd say just, and of course that one, it doesn't have the baggage of any of the other ones because it's like standalone. So I think that would be the one I'd go back to soonest.
So it's they're all canon films, and yet the fifth film is not canon.
Oh, I see what you did there. Yes,
it's very clever.
I think I don't know. It's a really tough one. I don't think two is my favorite personally. I think I liked. I thought four was better made than the other ones. I think, yeah, I can't choose between, it's like choosing between your kids, but then you've got one kid who's called American Ninja 3 Blood Hunt, and you just think, actually, I could probably do without you. I've got four other decent ones. Yeah.
And I wish I'd called you American Ninja 3 Sufficient Purchase.
So we got Sophie's Choice, get rid of the number three.
Well, please. Do you know what? I can lead straight on from that because I'm going to change the order I was going to talk about these films in. I'm going to talk about Gladiator Cop now.
Please do.
Because on the cover, again, straight from a DVD shop in Barrie, on the cover, it says Mortal Kombat meets Highlander. The story is Mortal Kombat meets Highlander. The film is called Gladiator Cop. On the cover, there's two gladiators fighting. On the disc, there's a closer picture of a ninja. It's not in the film. Don't worry about that. Just a picture of a ninja on the disc, which ties us nicely into your American Ninja talk. This film is wonderful, right? I think this is 1995, and it stars Lorenzo Lamas, who was also in, do you remember I watched those Snake Eater films a couple of months ago? It's the same guy, just with more luxurious hair. He kind of looks like Thomas Jane, but with a wig on. This film is I've made notes. It was so good, this and the next film was so good that I had to actually like pause and make notes. So the plot is that the sword of Alexander the Great is in a museum, and it gets stolen, and the man who steals it, the curator of the museum, gives the sword to a fighter who he then enters into an underground fighting tournament, like sort of melee weapon fighting tournament, to get lots of money, basically, so he can fuck off to Valverde. That's the plot, right? So it starts off, and the first thing you see is a load of kids in this Alexander the Great exhibit, and this museum curator, who I thought for a start, I thought, is that Robert Englund? But it's not. It's just someone who looks like it now. It comes in, and the kids are like having this talk about this sword, and which is the complete focal point of the film. And as the guide is talking about it, this guy who looks like Robert Englund, this museum curator, just Chris Kilos, his name is, he cuts in, he says, ah, yes, the sword of Alexander, and the kids will look at him. And then he goes up and starts fondling the case and says, oh, I've spent my whole life studying this sword. And he says, there's so many mysteries about it. For instance, the man who funded the excavation to find it died. And I thought, go on, how? Of a curse? Yeah. No.
Well, we know he would have died at some point.
Next scene. That's it. Wow. That's all you got. So someone died, right? Then it cuts back to him.
It's not the most intriguing mystery. That does happen quite often.
Then it comes back, not in 1974. Then it comes back to this Chris Kilos, this museum curator. And he goes to like a security guard and says, I need to be led into the rare exhibits. I need to check out an exhibit. And they're like, of course, Mr. Kilos. And he says, oh, it's A14. It's a small figurine of Alexander the Great. But then it cuts to him leaving with this box given to him by the security guard. It's not, is it? It's a golden skull. It's not what you said it was. So he goes to this underground fighting scene in like a car park somewhere, probably the car park outside Mainly Leisure Centre in Cardiff, and says, and goes up to the person organising it, like the guy organising the bet, and says, I'm going to come back tomorrow with a great fighter, and we're going to win this tournament sort of thing. And the guy's like, oh, fair enough, off you go. And you see this, and it's quite visceral fighting, actually. It's basically a little bit like The Quest with Roger Moore in the... Each character is almost like, and like Bloodsport, each character, like there's a butcher in it who fights with two butcher's knives. There's a guy called Mongol who fights with a huge scimitar. You know what I mean? There's sort of, an executioner with a big double-headed battle axe. So that's kind of cool. Anyway, so then it cuts to, he's obviously turned off the security footage and has arranged for these two thieves to come in and steal the sword, because he believes whoever holds the sword cannot lose in battle. He's based this on nothing. So we see these two thieves breaking in, and they sneak past the security guards. They go past all the security systems. They get one of those weird glass cutting compasses out. You know, it's like a suction cup in the middle, and then you cut round and remove the glass. And then, but they cut a circle really quietly, and then they just hit the glass with a hammer and set off all the alarms. And I thought, oh, didn't think that through. So that one guy, the guy who picks up the sword, kind of shivers as if he's been possessed by this spirit. And he then is this guy's fighter in these tournaments. It cuts then to Lorenzo Lamas, who does not really need to be in this film. And he's a cop But he keeps on having visions of Alexander the Great through these awful... This happened a lot in the 90s. When they would have flashbacks, it's like blue-filtered, heavy smoke effects and people like sort of whirling it as if it's a dreamscape, and it's just really irritating and badly edited. So he keeps having these dreams of these fights and stuff. And basically, all he does throughout the whole film until the final conflict, which is when he's actually needed, is he goes to unrelated murder scenes. And like when he touches a corpse, he basically just has like epileptic fits, and people like have to wake him up, and he's like, oh. And then he sort of says, oh, this person was murdered. And it's like, well, no shit, he's had his throat slashed. and he's like outside a pub. So yeah, and he just comes, it's really funny because no one like believes him, but then they start for no reason at all just like asking him, like there's a bit where his commanding officer says, oh, so how did he die? And he says, I don't know, I just know he was murdered. And he's like, well, that's not very helpful. It's like, no shit. Anyway, so it's kind of just completely superfluous to the plot for most of it. The main bulk of the plot is them working through this tournament and this guy fighting. But the main guy, just clearly, very clearly, even though he's got this sword of Alexander the Great, just gets his ass kicked constantly, like, and barely scrapes through fights. And yet, through the fights, when it's cutting back to this Robert Englund, Chris Milos character, he's acting as if it's all going to plan. And his facial expression, he's like really smug. And I said, he's getting his ass kicked. And you're really lucky that like the guy tripped on a stone or something and he managed to, and he fell on the guy's sword. But it's made out that he's this like great fighter. So it's like, oh, okay. One of the guys he fights Rupert in the, genuinely in a multi-story, they say, ah, yes. And whatever his name is, it's like Jotar fights Chung Lung. And this guy comes out with two like sighs. And I thought, is that Chung Lung or is that Sir Clive Sinclair if he lived above a grave? It's just this ginger man with like a shaved head and beard who's a bit chubby. So every fight he gets in, every fight he gets in, he lucks through. There's no reason, apart from these visions everyone keeps having, there's no reason to believe the sword is magic at all. There's a scene where Chris Kilos, this museum curator, who's like, the bets are getting higher and higher in each fight because he's working through the ranks with his Jotar fighter with his sword. There's a scene where he takes a prostitute to one of these fights, and she clearly thinks she's just gonna like suck him off behind odd bins or something, and he says, I'll get in the car, I've got something for you. And they go to this fight, and it's a horrendously violent fight where someone just gets murdered in front of her, and she sort of screams and just runs off. And then as the police turn up, and this museum curator is like being driven off by his driver, he looks back and can see the prostitute talking to the police, and he pulls this stupid face like, oh, why is she doing that? And I thought, because she probably thought she was going to suck you off for 40 quid and you took it to effectively a live snuff film. That's why. So, yeah, that tickled me. James Hong then rocks up. Of course he does.
Of course he does.
And says he's got a fighter called Mongol.
Still going strong, James Hong.
Yeah.
95.
He'll get everything ever all at once. He's beaten Ernest Borgnine and he's beaten Emmett Walsh. He says, I'm not going to do his accent, but he says, I have dedicated my entire life and I've traveled the world for decades to find this sword, and now it's finally within my grasp. And I thought, that's all well and good, James Hong, but it's been in a publicly visitable museum, hasn't it, for a long time. You could have just gone there and nicked it, couldn't you? You didn't have to wait until like you had to like get someone to fight through this ridiculous tournament. His character Mongol, the fighter Mongol, by the way, this like 7-foot giant with a huge scimitar, when his hood gets knocked off, just looks like a builder from like Norwich. So there's a scene in it where James Hong tells Chris Kilos to read a history book. It's a really bizarre scene where he says, come with me and you'll learn. And he starts meditating. And then Chris Kilos, this museum curator, just reads this book and reads about this story about that Alexander the Great's army like rose up against him and tried to sort of usurp the throne, but he got beaten down. And the head of this revolt was called like Perineum or something, and just says, that'll do. And he just looks up and he looks at James Hong met it and says, ah, you must be the reincarnated perineum. And and then, and that's it. He's just totally on board with it. There's a scene where but then I thought, well, you would know about that, wouldn't you? Because you're a museum curator who has said yourself that you'd, so why is this now news? And why are you suddenly believing James Hong, who's clearly your nemesis?
I'm getting the sense that the internal logic of this film isn't absolutely sound.
It's not.
Yeah.
Then there's a scene where the museum curator says to Jotar, we win the next fight and we'll have all this money. And then, bearing in mind, he's dedicated his life to having this sword and all of his wealth is based on this sword. His henchman, who's just no one really, says to him, when the fight is over, what do you want to do with the sword? And he goes, oh, just throw it away. And then Schmidt goes, oh, okay, and just wanders off with it. It's like, we probably wouldn't say that. You'd probably sell it for more money, would you? So this all builds up.
Lucky it's not a glaive that comes straight back at you, wouldn't it?
Yeah, cut your hand off. So this all builds up with the cop, Lorenzo Lamas, entering the fights called the Gladiator Cup. And he, you know, he obviously wins the final battle sort of thing. There's a bizarre, not a twist, but like an addition, a subplot at the end where Lorenzo Lamas's captain gets kidnapped by James Hong as like collateral, but Lorenzo Lamas doesn't know anything about it. So he kidnaps his captain while he's already getting ready for this tournament, off, you know, like working kind of off the book sort of thing. James Hong kidnaps his captain, who we've only seen a few times in the film, and says, oh, this will be a way to like make sure he does what we tell him. But they don't tell him anything. So he goes into the fight not knowing his captain's been kidnapped anyway. And it keeps on cutting back to this guy in a room. And then he just escapes. like it shows him just tied up in his room. And then all of a sudden he's just running through the crowd with a gun at the end to help out. And it's like, what? Yeah, it was.
We have to assume another Ronnie Cox moment, don't we?
We have to assume he just ripped them and then kicked it open. Yeah, so it's silly fun, but it's so 90s, it's so mid-90s and like sci-fi channel-y, but it's silly enough to kind of enjoy, so that's Gladiator Cop. Apparently a spiritual sequel to a film called The Swordsman from 1992.
Yes, well, yeah, this it seems like, from what I can surmise, it seems like the editor of the original Swordsman film basically took... He took a load of the footage from The Swordsman and repurposed it to make Gladiator Cop and brought in a few additional actors and characters. And essentially spliced them together. Probably explains why there are so many inconsistencies. But yes, it's so apparently it is genuinely standalone, but I don't know. They advertised it as a sequel. And actually Lorenzo Lamas, like his character, that's just footage from the original film. That's not even so he's headline actor, and yet he didn't even rock up on set for this one.
It sounds a little bit Deathstalkery then with the first and second and third. It would make sense because I looked at the director of it and apparently he literally made this film and another film a few years later, again, about someone getting the sword of Alexander the Great. So he's obsessed.
Nick Rotundo, fat bastard.
But yeah, it was enjoyable, but not as enjoyable as my next film, which is going to be the centerpiece of this entire podcast.
Shall I? Okay. I can quickly go through my last one here, actually.
Please do.
Which is called Bleeding Love. And this one was a screener that we were sent. And I think it is coming to cinemas shortly. It might even be in cinemas already.
It was released on the 12th, I believe, in cinemas.
Okay. Art house cinemas, I would imagine. It's not really a blockbuster. It's an indie movie, which made some minor waves at the South by Southwest Festival last year. It was originally titled You Sing Loud, I Sing Louder. So it's gone from having a slightly long-winded title to a slightly bland and forgettable one. So yeah, it's called Bleeding Love. And it's about a middle-aged man, played by Ewan McGregor, traveling across the Great Plains of America with his 20-year-old daughter who recently overdosed. He's basically helping her to get clean by taking her to a rehab facility. And obviously, it's a road trip movie. And obviously, along the way, their fractured relationship comes under the microscope. And the word obvious actually comes up a lot when I think of this film, because it's almost like AI constructed from a variety of cliches, really. And it has all the usual life lessons, ranging from patronizing to sanctimonious. It stars Ewan McGregor, as I said, and his real-life daughter, Clara McGregor, who seems to have followed in her father's footsteps by becoming a kind of okay actor. And yeah, a lot of cliches here about, you know, like life on the American road. You got these like big-hearted, oversharing mobile home yokels. You got a hooker with a heart of gold, a range of toxic men, and an AA meeting where Ewan McGregor's character talks painfully about his own agony of addiction. But you know what? Wouldn't you know it? He's really talking about his relationship with his daughter, because it's like metaphorical in it. So on this road trip, their relationship develops in the most predictable way imaginable. Like when he finally lets her drive, it's like they can't trust the audience to understand that her being allowed to drive is her growing up and realizing some autonomy. So he literally has to say to her, this is an actual line, it's up to you where we go next. Like, but it's not really, because we've actually got a specific place to go. So actually, if you could follow the directions, that would be really useful. It's directed by Emma Westenberg, who's a music video director, and written by someone called Ruby Caster, who's a first-time writer. So I don't want to be too harsh, but this is at best a well-meaning and I suppose inoffensive film, but it has an unbelievably clunky script which just touches on every trope in the sentimental rehabilitation story playbook. And technically it's kind of solid, although there's no real consistency to the aesthetic and style. Because like 1 minute it's going for like raw social realism, and then the next minute it looks like a Wild at Heart knockoff. It's like the greatest hits of 90s American new wave. And I just found it, I thought it just came across as phony. It's not like, it doesn't feel like a unique voice at all. And yeah, so you got this, it's predictable. You got this procession of tropes. You got this poor dialogue and this indistinct filmmaking, shall we say. And it all just adds up to a very boring film, unfortunately. Which is a pity, because I mean, I don't think much of the two main actors in it, but I like the idea of them, you know, real life father daughter kind of doing this slightly pain journey, but it's just too trashy and cliched.
Too on the nose. Well, that is a shame. I mean, I think I may like Ewan McGregor slightly more than you, but the genre in which this film falls isn't one that appeals to me.
I just never find him particularly convincing. I think he takes on some interesting roles, but just never really. Yeah, he just never really convinces. I'm always aware that he's acting. He doesn't draw me in. I don't know. But
well, like Steve James.
Well, yeah. At least Steve James can always just rely on just getting his top off and quipping with one-liners as he takes down ninjas who are clearly more skilled than him.
Well, that is a shame. But what isn't a shame is 1994's Champion Killer, the film that made me reinvigorate my love for movies. This film, Rupert, stars, well, it's directed by Junie Smith and stars Bennett Guillory as Bo Butler, who is a cop that, so the main structure is that he's a cop that, this is 1994, by the way, has his family murdered by a drug-addicted murderer and then spends the next couple of years just determined to track him down. But there's so much more to it than that. So what's of note is that the soundtrack is done entirely with the presets on a Casio keyboard.
Thank God.
I swear. I thought, have they just got like some sort of music like X on an Amiga 500 for this? Because it's just astonishing. Every scene is like, it's just like, are you just press like rock one on your keyboard? And so the killer is, if you imagine like a really, really gaunt John Bernthal, it starts off. And the beginning starts off, and it's Bo Butler and an undercover police officer, and he's having an affair with her behind his wife's back. He's got a wife and son, as illustrated by a really, really lengthy, tedious, hammy scene where like they're all around the breakfast table ruffling each other's hair and making jokes. It's painful. And then it cuts to the killer, who's this guy who like licks pictures of people on the wall, and He does a lot of coke right in this film, but he does it at such a speed that it's clearly he's like doing a line every few seconds and like really twitching. You think you would just be dead. You would just have a heart attack. You would be gone. So he finds out that Bo Butler is having an affair with this undercover police woman, and he kills her, and then he kills his wife and son, and the speed. At which this is done is literally within, I would say, 12 seconds. You kind of get the introductory scenes done, then it just shows everyone just being shot, like bang, bang, bang. And then it's a funeral. And there's a ridiculous scene where Bo Butler is like with his two partners, and they're standing up against the wall wearing suits as if they're outside a funeral parlor, and they're all like quite distraught, but he's really distraught, and he's trying to cover up the fact that he was having an affair even then. And he says, I can't believe it, he's killed my wife, my boy, and the police woman. And I said, right? So the one of the cops wanders off, and his mate, who's this sort of Hispanic cop, Bo Butler drops to his knees, his haunches, and he's got his head in his hands. And this Spanish cop just kind of like drops down next to him and just keeps kissing his head and saying it's okay. Like he's talking to a three-year-old who's fallen over and like hurt his knee. So it's okay, but it's okay. That's not how adults deal with grief. That's not what happens. There's a scene where the whole Champion Killer thing, on the synopsis in the back of the DVD case, it says the press dubbing the Champion Killer. Not true. The police just start calling him it. We never see any press in this film. They just say we need. And the captain says, "Oh, this Champion Killer," as if like someone else has given him the name, but it's never referred to. He just starts randomly shooting people, like men, women, the elderly, in this quick montage. But yet, whenever it cuts back to the police station, they keep on saying he's targeting young women. It's like that's not true. That's not true from the footage I've just seen. And there's a scene where you see him like run down a street with it. Obviously, they say it's like a rifle, but it's clearly a toy gun because it's really small in his hands. And he runs down the street, and there's no muzzle flash in this film. So he'll run up to someone, and he'll just like lift his arms up as if the gun's fired, and then there'll just be a gunshot on the soundtrack. And he runs up to a woman about 6 feet away from here, shoots her, and then runs away, right? Runs the bait where he's come, like a kid playing a prank down the street. And then it cuts to the crime scene, and Bo Butler turns up, and they say, he goes, oh, what happened here? And the cop in charge of the crime scene points into the distance at some houses and says, we think it was a high-powered sniper rifle, and the shot came from the rooftops over there, judging by the angle of entry. And Bo Butler goes, oh. And he literally looks down at his feet and goes, oh, here's the shell casing. And I said, well, that just disproves what that other gentleman said, didn't it, really? So then they match the shell up with the other murders, whatever. Then he has trouble tracking down this murderer. So the captain comes into his office, and apologies for the granular detail, but I have to get this out. The captain bursts onto a crime scene and says, you're not getting this guy. Butler, I need you in my office. And then it cuts to a close-up of the captain's face ranting at him for not being able to catch this killer. Mm. And like, you know, why, you need to get your head in the game. And then it pans to like a medium shot of the room they're in. And I'm going to try and describe this for you, right? The way Bo Butler is sitting, right? It is a maniac cop two beater. The captain has got his desk in like the back left corner of a room with his filing cabinets all around him. And he's got his chair facing this wall with a desk in front of him, like one of those mahogany desks with like, you know, like the green leatherette bit.
Yeah.
And Bo Butler is sat across his desk with his back up against the filing cabinet, like he's Burt Reynolds posing in a Playboy with like one leg up and one leg straight across, like on top of a load of paper. And he's shouting back. And I thought, if I said to someone, get into my office, I need to speak to you about something, and they got in and started clambering up on my desk, I'd say, what are you doing? Sit in the chair. Anyway, it's at that point that they say, we're going to get you a new partner, and they bring in this woman. And he thinks, oh, you know, another broad, but she actually kind of is really mouthy and he respects it for her, like how sort of feisty she is. Mm-hmm. And then there's scenes where they're like obviously falling in love with each other, falling for each other. And there's so many, and it begins with a sequence where they fail to stop another killing from this guy. And they're like, in the house, in the sort of downstairs living room in this woman's house, everything is peach. There's so many doilies everywhere. And she says, why don't you, if this get into so much, if you're struggling so much with this case, why don't you just do something else? And he goes in this like really rambling bad monologue about how, you know, it's the, being a cop is the only thing I'm ever good at. I'm being like humble bragging, like, you know, I'm a great cop, probably the best on the force. And, you know, it's the only thing I've ever done, you know, but, you know, I'm so good at it. And I thought, are you? There's no proof of that I've seen. So then it cuts again to them finding out that he sort of says, oh, you know, I'm going to kill this woman at this place. He starts to get cocky. And they literally see him waiting on a street corner with a gun, walking up to a woman. And they get out of the car. And the way he gets away from them is they're sort of running, but like Sam Fisher in the Splinter Cell games. So if you imagine two middle-aged people running, but like crouched down, yes. So it's really awkward. And they bump into each other and they fall over and sort of go, ooh! And he just turns around and sees them, starts running off. Like he's got like two second head start. And then they stand up and say, oh, we've lost him. The serial killer. Oh, he's gone. He's left. We've lost him. And so we probably could have run after him. And then she gets shot in the next exchange. And this leads to one of my favorite scenes in any film, right? She gets shot in the shoulder and it cuts to them in her bedroom. For some reason, she's got twin beds like it's a motel. So bear in mind, they're falling in love with each other and they're having this really intimate scene where he's sat in one bed and he's telling her, you know, I need you. You're a good partner. I need you on my back. We got to get this guy. And she literally says, actually, I've decided to become a teacher. And he says, what? And she's like, yeah, I just don't think this is for me. Even though she's like a life friend, she's really vivacious. She just completely changes character and becomes really meek, really mumsy. And as he's saying, oh, you know, if you think that's what's best, in her bedroom at nighttime, as she's in negligee under the sheets, her bedroom door opens, the captain walks in and just starts talking about the case. And they just say, oh, hey, Cap, not how did you get in? Not,
yeah,
what are you here at night? What's happening? He just starts talking about the case like they're at the police station and it's just completely normal. And he's in a full suit, obviously.
That's amazing.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. And this all leads up to the end where the killer gets a van full of kids and starts playing Simon Says with them. And it's this bizarre, protracted scene where he says, right, I'm trying to explain this properly. So there's a there's a woman in a minivan, or like a minibus, and she sat facing, like looking over his shoulder. He comes in, hits her with a gun across the face, which leaves this awful rash, like a burn. It's just really bad makeup. Right. And he's got this ridiculous like magnet with like an elongated barrel, and all the kids are screaming. And he gets on the bus, he puts his gun down next to him so the woman could just pick it up and shoot him. He's not looking at that. And he says to the kids, right, we're going to play Simon Says. So Simon Says, do this. Right. And he puts his hands in his face. Simon Says, do this. Put his hands in his head. And then he says, now do this. And he touches his shoulders and all the kids do it. And he says, oh, no, Simon Says didn't do that. He does that for 5 rounds of Simon Says, Rupert. Can you imagine how tedious that is to watch it? And then it cuts to the captain saying, we're going to have to get Butler out of, you know, retirement or whatever, because it's a few months later. He's the best cop. He's the only one that can stop this. And I thought, he's the champion killer cop. And he says, yeah, I'll do it. He shoots the bloke, just turns up and shoots him. It's a really like disappointing ending. And the final scene is him like looking around, like he shoots the guy dead. And then he looks around and it genuinely looks like he's wondering why no one has said cut. He just sort of looks around, like out of character, like confused, like looking slowly around for no reason. There's nothing around him. And then the credits roll.
Oh, that is bizarre.
And that is the film.
Like a little fourth wall breaking moment at the end. That's amazing.
It was the film that lit my love for cinema again, let me tell you. It was that was the one that Faye could not believe what was happening. Like, why are they sitting like that? Why are they here now? Why she wants to be a teacher now, does she? It was fantastic. Champion
sounds
killer.
Like it absolutely trounced the test.
Oh yeah, the six what test? He was in double figures, so an absolute keeper that was.
Champion killer. Where is that? Is that just available on DVD, double-sided DVD? Or?
It was a single-sided DVD in a charity shop, so it's there's a little bit of quality there.
Maybe I'll.
You've run out of films, haven't you?
I'm done. Yeah, I am done and dusted.
Are we okay to do 1.5?
Yeah, sure.
Yep. Just want to talk. I mean, this can be as long as you want, really. Because of the passing of M. Emmett Walsh, I watched Blood Simple, 1984, Coen Brothers. I think it was the first film, Coen Brothers?
Yeah, I think it was the first major feature. I don't know whether they did something before that, but yes, regarded as their first, yeah.
Yeah, I saw this film a long time ago, and I remember liking it. But I watched it.
That's pretty much where I am. I literally haven't seen it in about 20 years.
Yeah. It genuinely feels like a unique film because I said to Faye, I was like, I really want to watch an M. Emmett Walsh film. She recognized him and I said, I really want to watch Blood Simple. And she was like, what is it? And I said, it's kind of like a noirish sort of thriller. And she was bang up for it, but it's got so many sort of layers to it because it starts off and it genuinely feels like a slasher because it starts off with, I think his name is John Getz John Getz and Francis McDormand, and they're just driving down this highway and the whole soundtrack is, it's quite synthy, but it's all based on like heartbeats. So like even when the windscreen wipers are sort of going, it's all this like time bum bum bum. It's just quite hypnotic sort of vibe to it. And John Getz is this really bizarre screen presence because he's kind of goofy, but he's meant to be kind of a bit of a hunk in this film. But then everyone is kind of like, Frances McDormand isn't the classic beauty, is she? But she's treated as the sort of femme fatale. And it's this really noirish scene where he's talking to her in this really monotone drone voice. Like she's talking about her husband, how things aren't working out and how, and he's like, I like you. I've always liked you. And then she sort of talks and talks about a marriage. And then he says, I ain't a marriage counselor. And he's got this kind of weird monotone drawl. And I thought, this is very horror-y, you know, this whole vibe. And then it sort of continues on. And what I love about it is, well, there's many things I loved about it. M. Emmett Walsh's character is introduced. And he's effectively, he starts off as like a really sleazy private investigator. But again, it's all, I think it's based in Texas. And he can go in the same scene from being like this kind of goofy like Texan telling stupid jokes to like a real nasty slimy sleazeball with like flies landing on his face as he talks and like licking his lips to like a genuinely threatening presence. And but yet, in through that, there's also scenes where, and the heart of the film to me, what made me laugh out loud at certain points, is just the fact that the film could be solved if people just had full conversations with each other. But everything's so sort of guarded and sort of half-uttered that things are just completely misconstrued. And that is what propels the plot. And I love films like that when they're done properly.
Yes.
And also, I was laughing out loud. There's a scene where Dan Hedaya, who's her Frances McDormand's husband, who runs this like sort of bar/strip joint thing, he gets killed by M. Emmett Walsh. Right, this is 1984, so I'm allowed to spoil it. And this is kind of what kicks everything off. He hides pictures in his safe that proves that M. Emmett Walsh is involved. So M. Emmett Walsh needs the pictures back, but because of something Frances McDormand has said that he kind of half heard, John Getz kind of believes that she's killed him so they could be together. And he turns up at this crime scene, right? And Dan Hedaya is supposedly dead in this chair, dead, shot back. And the way that you realize John Getz's character is fantastic. He's obviously just completely not mentally, doesn't have the mental acumen to deal with the situations he's constantly thrust into in this film, but it's all done in a way that's not goofy or not like slapsticky, but just through what he does, like unspokenly. So the first thing he does, right, is he tries to clean up the crime scene by taking off his plastic sports jacket and wiping the floor. And then he realizes this is all done like not for joke. It is funny, but in a really dry way. Then he realizes he's just making the problem worse. So he goes and like wraps his coat around it. Oh no, he wraps a towel around his coat and then comes back to do it. and it takes ages. And then he just like picks up the gun that he's found when he's cleaning the floor. He sees a gun that's been kicked like under a sideboard and he picks it up. Like plays with it in his hands for ages, so it's covered in fingerprints. And then he kind of raises his eyebrows and then puts the gun in Dan Hedaya's pocket as if, oh, now it'll just look like he shot himself. And
this is like something I would do. Like if I was
and it's brilliant and it keeps on happening. There's another fantastic. Do you mind me talking about this a little bit? Because I really love this film. There's a scene as well where Dan Hedaya, it becomes clear that he's not dead. So he drives out. So he puts Dan Hedaya's corpse in his car, John Getz, and he drives out to the middle of nowhere, like, you know, where they have billboards, and it's just like a building site sort of thing, like the foundations of a building site. And he's got a shovel, and it's like he's going to bury him and just leave him there so the town gets built over his corpse. But he keeps on, like, pussying out of it, and he's like, he can't be sure how to kill him. So, like, first of all, he points a gun at him, and then he sort of says, no. And then he, like, goes to hit him with a shovel, and he's like, no. And then he goes to bury him, and he can't bring himself to do that. And he's so, like, just doesn't know how to deal with the situation. I was really laughing at this, like, quite dark sequence, but it's just so well done. And it culminates, that sequence culminates with him going back to this shitty apartment he shares with Frances McDormand. Good. So he goes back, starts smoking loads of fags and says, I've solved the problem. And she's like, where have you been? What problem? And he sort of laughs and says, I like it. That's fine. You keep it like that. Don't you worry about it. And she's like, what are you talking about? And he sort of stands up and says, don't make a fool out of me. Don't make a fool out of me. And she's like, seriously, what's happening? And then she says something that she says a line that Dan Hedaya hinted at earlier on. And John Getz does this laugh and like, it's been misconstrued like another level again. And so she goes to this crime scene and finds that Dan Hedaya is not there, but sees that the safe was dropped. Someone's trying to smash into the safe. And misconstrues it again and then leaves, and the plot thickens more. And basically, this is brilliant. And it all lines up with this really minimalist soundtrack. It leads up to this sequence where she's in an apartment, a two-room apartment, and M. Emmett Walsh turns up to kill her. And it's it's such a good sequence. He just turns from like goofy to threatening. And it's just, it's this really tense, like 20-minute slasher sequence that ends the film. And it finished. And Faye really enjoyed it. And I thought to myself, that is a fantastic film, a beautiful little indie film that I will watch occasionally back for the rest of my life, because it's just, yep, it feels really special. And what's even more bizarre is this Coen brothers kind of dismiss it now and just say it's really crass and it's just like the worst feature. But I've seen Hail Caesar, so I know that to not be accurate.
I mean, Hail Caesar isn't even the worst. They did that dodgy Lady Killers remake as well, didn't they?
Yeah, I was being facetious. I didn't mind Hail Caesar, but...
But, like, I realise, like, especially with you talking about Blood Simple as well, like, they're at their best when they're, like, and funniest when they're making serious films, if you see what I mean. Like, actually, when they go all out for comedy, I suppose The Big Lebowski is an all-out comedy, but I don't know, like, when you look at stuff like Intolerable Cruelty and Burn After Reading and Hail Caesar, then just... they're funnier when they are making a serious movie, which happens to be like ironically funny, like just because of its absurdity. Stuff like Blood Simple and Barton Fink.
There's the humor. I've never seen Barton Fink, and I really like The Big Lebowski. So but with Blood Simple, the humor comes from an understanding that the audience is kept up with the plot.
Yeah.
And it's not overstated. So, but yeah, like you say, with I haven't seen the lady. What was the other film you mentioned? Lady Killers. But I liked Burn After Reading. But I think I liked actors in it.
Yeah.
Yes, as opposed to the film itself. Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, and like even like No Country for Old Men, which is so dead serious in so many ways. Even that's got kind of like absurdist humor in it, like just the sheer grimness of and like misfortune that befalls people in it. It's still kind of funny, and I kind of prefer that. There, yeah, I like Blood. I remember liking Blood Simple. I haven't seen
you should watch it again. It's an absolute pleasure to watch. I've got to say as well, the first part of the film that made me laugh is there's a sequence when Dan Adair finds out that Frances McDormand is shagging John Getz, and she says, and he says to her after they've had sex, I'm going to go and speak to him. And she says, why? That's like the worst thing you could do. Let's just move on from sort of. And he's now going to talk to him man to man. And it cuts to Dan Hedaya, and he's just sat outside his property looking in like a furnace. And his staff are like throwing in broken chairs at this furnace. And he's just looking off into the fire. And John Getz stands in front of him and starts smoking and says, well... And he says, well, what? And he says, well, do you want to punch me? You're going to fire me? You're going to shoot me? And Dan Adair sort of frowns without looking at him and says, well, I don't particularly want to speak to you. and it's such a, why would you want to speak to the man who's having an affair with your wife? It was just brilliant. And it's that kind of humor that really tickled me all the way through it. Yes. So that Blood Simple, absolute classic. Really quickly, final 2 minutes here, I watched half of Rising Sun, Sean Connery and Wesley Snipes. Okay. Didn't watch all of it because I signed up to Apple TV and then forgot to watch it within 48 hours. £4 wasted. This film is like, I can't really comment on it, but I want to say that, you know, the actor Stan Shaw?
No. Well, it doesn't ring a bell.
Kind of like a burly black guy. He was the security guard in Daylight who breaks his neck and has a really sad scene in that.
Oh, I know him. Yes.
Yeah, he's got eyes that elicit sadness.
Yes.
Basically, I just wanted to say about this film. Like I said, I can't talk about it. I will watch it fully. There's a scene in this film that's possibly the worst acting I've ever seen by him, and I just want to say it out loud because it was so bad. I'm surprised they didn't do a second take. He plays a security guard in this film, and Sean Connery and Wesley Snipes go into his office to ask for some footage, and he clearly doesn't want to give it to them because he knows his boss will know he's giving it to them and he'll get in trouble. And he is like doing like Amdram hand-wringing, like overacting. And when they say to him, we know you've got the footage, can you just give it to us? He literally looks off to one side and mouths the word damn. Can you imagine that in a film? He looks off and goes, damn. And I thought, this isn't, you're not on stage outside Mandy Leisure Centre, mate. This is like, you're in a film. It was single worst. I'm not an actor, but it was the single most, I was really cringing. I thought, oh, that was bad. So yeah, I won't talk about that, but I know it's running late. We've gone to our 2-hour limit. So we have to move on to the Arkansdale.
Oh yeah.
So how did you go? So it was Annette Bening to John Candy.
It was, and actually I found this weirdly easy in the end.
Okay.
Because John Candy is in JFK with Kevin Costner, who's in Open Range, of course, with Annette Bening. Just a two-stepper.
That's a lovely two-stepper, Rupert.
Oh.
There's a podcast first coming up. Okay. Waxy O'Connor said Annette Bening is in Mars Attacks with Martin Short, who's in Three Amigos with Steve Martin, who's in A Little Shop of Horrors with John Candy.
Mm.
And then he said, I'm getting this to you in case I A, forget, or B, don't find a shorter path. I'm assuming both of those are true. David, I'll call him David Chod because it's like Chodkevsky, and I don't want to butcher his surname. So David Chod said, Annette Bening was in Open Range with Kevin Costner, who's in JFK with John Candy.
Good work.
Ed Welban says, nice, I'm coming in with American Beauty with Kevin Spacey, to The Usual Suspects with Kevin Pollock, who's in Canadian Bacon with John Candy, which is a nice one.
Nice, yeah.
Our occasional co-host and constant lover, Laszlo, says, yo, a mediocre three-stepper for you, and I'm especially sorry for going the Marvel route. But I have Annette Bening, was in Captain Marvel with Sam Jackson, who was in Kill Bill with Daryl Hannah, who was in Splash with John Candy.
Yes.
But Rupert, there is a no stepper. There is a film they are both in together.
Oh, wow. And
our regular, it's taken 86 episodes to get to this moment. But Utah Smith says Annette Bening and John Candy were both in The Great Outdoors.
Were they? Okay.
So yes, so a little clap for Utah there.
Well done.
It's a no stepper. So that's, yeah, we've done it. So I guess now we have to go on to film of the week.
Film of the week.
Champion Killer reignited my love for movies. Yeah, because it was just so wonderfully ramshackle, but Blood Simple was a good film. Yeah. And the fact that its own director has sort of said, their own directors have been like, oh, it's our worst film. Wrong. It is an absolute treasure of a film.
I'm going to go with American Ninja 5, purely because it's the one that I'd be most likely to watch again as a single item, if you see what I mean.
Yeah,
I mean, clearly I'd want to watch all five films back to back. But
You're not a stupid man, are you?
No, I should really just say the American Ninja franchise, because it surprisingly sustains its mediocre quality.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, for the next, I guess, you know, next time we're going to have a lot more movie action. I'm diving back in. I'm actually working through my Charity Shop DVD back catalogue to make some space for more under my TV. Yep. So I'm going to be coming at you from all angles next time. But until then, Rupert, I love you and long live the memory of M.M. Walsh.
One more thing.
Oh, yeah.
We need to choose the Arkansas for next time.
Oh, crikey, of course. I totally forgot about that.
Well,
I'm going to say M.M. Walsh.
Okay, hang on. Let me think.
So that gives people Blood Simple, The Jerk.
Yep. Blade Runner. Let me think now, because let's have someone.
That's nice, because that's a man whose career has spanned decades, so it's very multi-generational.
Should we go for...
Please say David Bradley.
I think that might be a little bit tough.
People would struggle.
They really would. We could say to Pat Morita. Is that unfair?
No, why? Why would that be unfair?
Because Pat Morita, I mean, he's not the most prolific. Because seeing as people found this last one remarkably easy, we got a no stepper. I think our listeners need to be punished with a really difficult one.
Punished for beating you.
Yeah, exactly. This is my bitterness coming out here. M.M. Walsh to Pat Morita.
Absolutely.
This is where we find out that M.M. Walsh was in Karate Kid.
Yeah, he was actually in American Ninja 5.
He actually was in Karate Kid.
My God, that would be a different film. It's been a good episode. I've enjoyed this. I've enjoyed a lot of films. I've enjoyed your company, and I've enjoyed our listenership. Now I'm going to enjoy one of my magazines.
Mm-hmm. I love you.
I love you more.
Bye.